Despite the persistent legal questions swirling around Burisma, Archer and Hunter Biden carried the flag around the globe, serving to legitimize the activities of the company. Devon Archer represented Burisma at the Louisiana Gulf Coast Oil Exposition in late 2015. Hunter Biden attended and addressed the Energy Security for the Future conference in Monaco. Sponsored by Prince Albert II of Monaco, Biden joined him on stage along with former Vice Chancellor of Germany, Joschka Fischer. How much were Biden and Archer paid by Burisma? There is no way of knowing. They are not required to disclose their compensation. One can only imagine that lending one's name to a suspect company would require a large sum. Given the large sums businesses pay for advertising, public relations, and marketing, one wonders how much Burisma would invest in gaining credibility by appointing two very politically connected Americans to their board. Professor Oliver Boyd Barrett, who has written about Ukraine, estimated that the deal with Burisma could be enormous. Potentially, he wrote, the Biden family could become billionaires. While we cannot trace the sums of money going to Hunter Biden and Devon Archer, we can map the funds and benefits flowing to Burisma's owners at the direction of Hunter Biden's father, Vice President Joe Biden, and Devon Archer's confidant, Secretary of State John Kerry. The transactions raise questions not only because of their timing, but also the large sums of money involved. Recall that controversial oligarch and Burisma owner Kolomoisky had been barred entrance into the United States because of legal concerns about his activities in the Ukraine. But in 2015, after Biden and Archer joined the board, that changed. With the intervention of the U.S. Embassy in Kiev, he was given admittance back into the United States. Then there was the disappearance of $1.8 billion in U.S. taxpayer-guaranteed money. Both Joe Biden and John Kerry championed $1.8 billion in taxpayer-backed loans to be given to Ukraine courtesy of the IMF. The funds were being loaned to the country to keep the country's financial markets liquid. Much of that money would go through Kolomoisky's Privyat Bank, and more than $1 billion of it just simply disappeared. Where did that money go? We can actually follow the egress of this large sum of money into offshore private accounts thanks to investigative work by a Ukrainian anti-corruption watchdog group called Nashe Groshe, or Our Money. Nashe Groshe mapped the complex flow of money by researching a series of court judgments of the Economic Court of the Ukraine's Dnipropetrovsk region, where Kolomoisky was governor until he left the country. The watchdog says it worked like this. 42 Ukrainian firms owned by 54 offshore entities registered in Caribbean, American, and Cypriot jurisdictions and linked to or affiliated with the Privyat group of companies took out loans from Privyat Bank in Ukraine to the value of $1.8 billion. The firms then ordered goods from six foreign supplier companies, three of which were incorporated in the United Kingdom, two in the British Virgin Islands, one in the Caribbean statelet of St. Kitts and Nevis. Payment for the orders, $1.8 billion, was shortly afterwards prepaid into the vendors' accounts, which were, coincidentally, in the Cyprus branch of Privyat Bank. Once the money was sent, the Ukrainian importing companies arranged with Privyat Bank Ukraine that their loans be guaranteed by the goods on order. Of course, it was all a scam, and the complex corporate structure a decoy screen. No supplier companies provided any goods. The $1.8 billion effectively disappeared from Privyat, laundered through a network of offshore entities. This transaction of $1.8 billion with the help of fake contracts was simply an asset siphoning operation, the watchdog explained. By December 2016, Ukrainian authorities were forced to nationalize Kolomoisky's Privyat Bank when it was discovered that the bank was collecting savings from Ukrainians and then engaging in massive insider lending, whereby mysterious front corporations were taking large loans and then not paying them back. Huge sums of money had simply disappeared. The Ukrainian government, supported by taxpayer dollars from the West, was forced to take ownership of the bank and make sure customers did not lose their money. One Ukrainian lawmaker called it the greatest robbery of Ukraine's state budget of the millennium. When money disappears, The people who lent that money want answers. And so, at the behest of angry officials in the United States and the West, an investigation was launched. Burisma company founder Mikolas Lachevsky, the stocky former environmental minister, worked deftly to avoid criminal charges. In February 2016, Ukrainian authorities seized his property on suspicion that he had engaged in illicit enrichment. Zlochevsky fled the country and was placed on Ukraine's wanted list. The Ukrainian Prosecutor General's office actually seized Burisma's gas wells. Tax authorities began investigating him for suspicion of tax evasion. But then, almost as quickly as the investigation into Zlochevsky and Burisma was launched, it was halted. On January 16, 2017, Air Force 2 was descending on Borispol Airport, just southeast of Ukraine's capital. This would be Joe Biden's last foreign trip before leaving office. It was cold and dark. Dressed in an overcoat, he descended the stairs quickly and was met by a delegation from the foreign ministry on the tarmac. This was his Ukrainian swan song, as Reuters put it, a farewell visit by one of Ukraine's strongest political supporters. The Obama administration, under Biden's direction, had poured some $3 billion into the country. Later that evening, he met with the Prime Minister of Ukraine, and then a late evening meeting with his friend Petro Poroshenko, the Ukrainian president. As the Kiev Post reported, that latter meeting was to be behind closed doors, and details of most of their discussion won't be made public. 4 days before Biden arrived, Burisma made a dramatic announcement. The Ukrainian criminal investigations into the company and its founder had been ended by Ukrainian government prosecutors. Since all legal proceedings against Burisma Group are closed, the company announced, it will allow us to increase production volumes and the flow of foreign investments in Ukraine, consider attracting international companies in the country, fulfill social and investment responsibilities, as well as duly pay in full all required tax liabilities in the budget. This is a big step forward for Ukraine in general and Burisma Group in particular. Joe Biden met with Ukrainian President Poroshenko and was warmly greeted by Ukrainian officials, who saw him as their strongest advocate in the West. Biden urged the United States and the West to stand behind the Ukrainian government. The international community must continue to stand as one against Russian coercion and aggression, he told reporters, standing beside Poroshenko. Despite the enormous evidence of corruption and criminal activity in Burisma, Devon Archer remained involved with the company through the end of 2016, while Hunter Biden, as of this writing, still serves as a member of the board and provides legal assistance. They have never disclosed their compensation. And the more than $1 billion that disappeared from their business partner's bank has never been recovered. The Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota is a world away from the Ukraine. But the story here helps put Archer's global activity and Rosemont Seneca's methods in context. Home to one of the poorest Native American tribes in the United States, the Oglala Sioux, it has struggled over the years to attract investment and business opportunities for tribal members. Beginning in 2014, the tribe was fleeced, courtesy of a complex fraudulent scheme involving a known con artist, a man once proclaimed porn's new king, and Kerry confidant and Rosemont Seneca partner, Devon Archer. It was an audacious scheme. For more than 2 years, Archer worked with a handful of other individuals to extract more than $60 million in bond money from the tribe. Proceeds that were supposed to go to the tribe ended up being used to purchase luxury goods and line the coffers of the scammers. Caught up in the scheme was a company called Burnham Asset Management. Hunter Biden served as the vice chairman of the company. Devon Archer sat on the board of directors. Millions would flow through an entity run by Archer called Rosemont Seneca Bohai. It would end with the May 2016 arrest of Devon Archer by federal agents. In March 2014, a large man with a long record of fraudulent financial schemes ventured to Las Vegas, Nevada to attend the National RES, or Reservation Economic Summit. It was an economic development conference for Indian reservations from across the country. John Galanis, with a heft of nearly 400 pounds, had been behind the pump-and-dump stock deal involving the Hair Extension Center and a real estate deal in which he bilked Eddie Murphy and Sammy Davis Jr. out of money. In 1988, he was sentenced to 27 years in prison for tax shelter fraud. In 2000, Forbes magazine called him one of the biggest white-collar criminals of recent decades. His son Jason was reportedly involved in investment schemes of his own. In 2003, he was dubbed Porn's New King for his early online porn payment processing site. According to Forbes magazine, while in jail, John was directing Jason's financial activities and was calling his son Collect 30 times a day to discuss business matters. In Vegas, the Galanises sat down with the leaders of the Wakpomni Lake Community Corporation, a tribally chartered economic development corporation owned by the Oglala Sioux. They suggested that the tribe issue bonds to raise capital for economic projects. Tribal leaders were eager to invest in a winery, among other ventures. With a deal in the making, Jason reached out to Devon Archer and another finance guy, Bevan Cooney, to offer them a part of it. On April 4, 2014, Jason wrote them an email with the subject line, Oglala Native Spirits Memo. .docx. The body of the email said, $20 million bond approved. Proceeds are $15 million to us and $5 million to them for a winery investment they want to make. Devon Archer and his association with Biden and Kerry would prove to be an attractive, legitimizing factor for the Galanises' activities. As Jason Galanis sought investors, he would email promotional materials to use when appropriate to demonstrate who your financial sponsors are. Under leadership, the first name to appear was Devon Archer, managing partner of Rosemont Group, a $2.4 billion private equity firm co-owned by Hunter Biden and Chris Hines. It went on to note that he was vice chairman and investment committee member of Bohai Harvest RST. In August, the first bond issuance worth $27 million was released. Less than 2 months later, on October 1st, a second bond issuance of $15 million took place. Who bought those bonds? According to the SEC, they diverted the proceeds from the first bond sale to buy into the second, using Rosemont Seneca Bohai LLC to do it. Around August 15, 2014, Jason Galanis, whose nickname was Greek, sent another email to Archer and Cooney about the legal execution of the bond sale. This is pure genius a la Mikey Milken, wrote back Cooney. The Native American bonds. Great work here, Greek. On September 24, 2014, $15 million was transferred into the Rosemont Seneca Bohai brokerage account in New York from an entity called Thorsdale. But the money did not stay there long. On October 1st, Rosemont Seneca Bohai LLC purchased the entirety of the second tribal bond issuance for $15 million. When a brokerage firm associated with the deal asked where the $15 million had come from, the government alleges that Archer lied and said, the funds used to purchase the bonds were from real estate sales through my business Rosemont Seneca Bohai LLC. But of course, that was not true. The funds had been misappropriated from the first tribal bond issuance. A little more than 6 months later, on April 9, 2015, Rosemont Seneca Bohai LLC transferred those $15 million in tribal bonds into an obscure brokerage account in Bermuda called VL Assurance. As U.S. prosecutors would point out, Rosemont did not receive anything of economic substance, such as an equity interest in VL Assurance Bermuda Limited, in exchange for this transfer. According to federal investigators and prosecutors, the proceeds of these bond sales were misappropriated and went into various projects. Money that was supposed to go to the tribe ended up being used for the benefit of the Galanises and Devon Archer. Some of the proceeds went into a legal defense fund for John and Jason Galanis, who had legal bills related to another financial scheme. Some went to luxury items. The Galanises poured tribal bond money into purchasing high-priced items from Prada, Gucci, and Valentino, among others. Other money ended up in Devon Archer's pockets, including over $700,000. Some ended up in the accounts of Rosemont Seneca Bohai. Some of that money may have found its way into another Rosemont entity. Rosemont Seneca Technology Partners, which listed Hunter Biden as an advisor and Chris Hines as an investor, created a joint venture with the state of Hawaii called Mbloom to incubate high-tech companies in the islands. On May 19, 2015, a small high-tech company called Code Rebel had an IPO on the Nasdaq stock market. The company was headed by Arben Kresju, a Kosovo-born German citizen who was running Mbloom. As alleged by the SEC, Jason Galanis and two others used tribal bond proceeds to buy up to 87% of the stock on that day, driving the stock up from its $5 offering price to $15 a share. Buying the remaining shares were Devon Archer and a few other investors. The scheme began to unravel when tribal leaders wondered where the money was going. Federal authorities launched an investigation, and on May 11, 2016, Devon Archer and the others involved in the scheme were arrested and charged with conspiracy to commit securities fraud. They had also used pension funds to buy the bonds and quickly faced civil cases as well. The pension fund for workers at Michelin, the tire company, sued Archer and the others in court, alleging that the defendants had raided the proceeds from closing the bonds in order to create a slush fund that would pay certain defendants directly and indirectly to support their lifestyles, legal fees, and speculative ventures. According to the criminal complaint, $700,513 ended up going to Archer via the Rosemont Seneca Boahai LLC account. Both the criminal charges and the civil lawsuits named Devon Archer, but no one else connected with Rosemont Seneca. Did Archer go rogue? While there is no direct evidence that Hunter Biden or Chris Hines knew of the tribal bonds scheme, the corporate structure of their business together suggests that they could have, and maybe should, have known. In the criminal complaint, prosecutors noted that Archer was the founder of Rosemont Capital LLC and was connected with Burnham Asset Management. Hunter Biden's name was not mentioned. The business that was used to transfer the money was Rosemont Seneca Boahai. According to legal records in New York, Rosemont Seneca Boahai uses the same business address as the other Rosemont entities involving both Biden and Hines. It is also interesting to note that Rosemont Seneca Boahai LLC is also listed as a shareholder on the Boahai Harvest RST deal in China. There were large sums of money, sometimes $15 million, passing through the Rosemont Seneca Boahai bank accounts. Hunter Biden was a partner in Rosemont Seneca. He was also the vice chairman of Burnham. Did he not notice? Devon Archer was arrested in May 2016 for his alleged role in the tribal bonds scam. The Ukrainian news agency story said it all. Burisma Holdings board director Archer arrested, blared the headline. As of this writing, he is awaiting trial. Jason Galanis has been sentenced to 14 years for his involvement in the scam. Following Archer's arrest, his name was removed from the Burisma board. Hunter Biden remains on the board and as an advisor to Burisma. The environs of the White House are not the only place you will find American princelings. They also roam at the highest levels of Capitol Hill. 5. McConnell and Chow. From China with Profits. Senator Mitch McConnell and his wife Elaine Chow benefit from close ties to the Chinese military-industrial complex. Chow's family has reaped large profits thanks to the Chinese government. McConnell has become less critical of Beijing as those relationships have blossomed. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and his wife Elaine Chao operate at the highest levels of government. They are one of the most powerful couples in the United States, with McConnell climbing to become the senior senator in the United States, while his wife, Chao, has been a member of the cabinets of two presidents, Secretary of Labor under George W. Bush and Secretary of Transportation under Donald Trump. She previously was the head of the Federal Maritime Commission. Along the way, she has served on numerous corporate boards. McConnell and Chow have seen their wealth increase dramatically in a matter of just a few years. In 2004, they had an average net worth of $3.1 million, according to public disclosures, well below the Senate average of $14.5 million. 10 years later, they had a net worth of between $9.2 million and $36.5 million. The key? In 2008, they received a gift from Elaine Chao's father, James. The Chao family fortune comes from the Foremost Maritime Corporation, later renamed Foremost Group, a shipping firm that her father founded and which remains a family business. James Chao is the chairman, and Elaine's youngest sister, Angela, is deputy chairwoman, running the day-to-day operations. Another sister, Christine, is Foremost's general counsel. Elaine worked for the company in the 1970s. "Shipping is our family tradition," Elaine said in a 2016 speech at the National Taiwan Ocean University. So what family role do McConnell and Chao play exactly? As these two have held court in Washington, Foremost has thrived, thanks in large part to close relations with the Chinese government. As McConnell and Chao have risen in political stature, these relationships have only strengthened. Senator McConnell's father-in-law and sister-in-law have served on the board of directors of a Chinese government-owned military contractor. Another sister-in-law has been appointed to the government-controlled Bank of China, only the second foreign national to serve on that board. The Chao's shipping company has done large volumes of business with the China State Shipbuilding Corporation, or CSSC. While Foremost is based out of the United States, their ships have been constructed by Chinese government shipyards, and some of their construction financed by the Chinese government. Their crews are largely Chinese. Ironically, Elaine Chao, as the U.S. Secretary of Transportation, has maintained that ships crewed by Americans are a vital part of our national security. And their cargo vessels have done considerable business with Chinese state-owned companies. The story of the Chows has all the elements of a classic immigrant success story. James Chao came to the United States to continue his education in 1958. His wife, Ruth Mulan Chu, and three daughters, including 8-year-old Elaine, joined him in 1961. In 1964, James Chao launched Foremost Maritime Corporation. Once in the United States, the Chows welcomed three more daughters. They all excelled academically, each attending elite colleges. As the family grew, so did the business. Elaine became a White House fellow during the Reagan administration and rose to become the chairman of the Federal Maritime Commission. In 1987, she met a relatively new senator named Mitch McConnell, who had taken office in 1985 to represent the state of Kentucky. The Chao family began donating heavily to McConnell's campaigns. Mitch and Elaine started dating in 1991 and were married in 1993. Elaine describes the relationship as a bit of a surprise. "I thought I would marry a nice Chinese boy," she recounted for one reporter, "but I'm too tall." So she found a nice senator from Kentucky. Still, James Chao remained the traditional head of the family. When there is a family dinner, no one touches the food before James Chao, not even Senator McConnell. The wedding was a traditional affair. Senator McConnell described it as an exceedingly joyful day. But who attended spoke of what would lie ahead. Wedding attendees included family, friends, and the Chinese representative to the United Nations, a family friend. Months after the wedding, in December 1993, Senator McConnell found himself in Beijing for a series of private meetings with the most senior officials in the Chinese government. This was not a congressional trip or something arranged by his Senate office. The meetings were arranged by McConnell's new father-in-law, James Chao, and came at the invitation of the China State Shipbuilding Corporation, or CSSC. McConnell met with Chinese President Jiang Zemin, a classmate of James Chao, at Jiao Tung University in China decades ago. There was also a private meeting with the Chinese Vice Premier Li Lanqing. So why was McConnell in Beijing for these meetings? Were these meetings political or commercial? The answer is they likely were both. As is so often the case in Beijing and Washington, politics and business are deeply intertwined. At the time, in 1993, China was isolated internationally. In June 1989, the Chinese government had sent thousands of troops into Tiananmen Square, leading to the massacre of an unknown number of Chinese students, perhaps over 500. An estimated 10,000 people were arrested. McConnell was only the second Republican U.S. senator to visit the country since the massacre. The Chinese government made sure to publicize his visit. But this also had the appearance of a business meeting. According to the Chinese government, McConnell and the Chow family arrived in Beijing at the invitation of the China State Shipbuilding Corporation. In 1997, there was another private meeting among Zhang, Senator McConnell, and Elaine Chao, this time around the official state Chinese dinner in Washington. There would be future private meetings with the Chinese leaders who would follow Zhang. The CSSC would come to play a central role in the family's financial success, and Mitch McConnell would increasingly avoid public criticism of China. As the Chows and the Chinese government went into business together, the Chows-McConnells tied their economic fate to the good fortunes of Beijing. Were McConnell to critique Beijing aggressively or support policies damaging to Chinese interests, Beijing could severely damage the family's economic fortunes. The evolution of Senator McConnell's views on China are on public record. In 1989, just after the Tiananmen Square massacre, McConnell gave a hardline speech at the University of Louisville. McConnell was a member of the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations at the time. "We'll never forget the sight of those young people without arms up against tanks and machine guns," he said. Later that year, it was revealed that then-President George H.W. Bush covertly sent two close aides, including National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft, to meet with Chinese officials. McConnell was the only Republican in the Senate to criticize the mission. In 1991, with free and democratic Hong Kong set to be turned over to Chinese control in 1997, McConnell sponsored the U.S. Hong Kong Policy Act of 1992. The law called on China to preserve Hong Kong's market economy once it returned to Beijing's control in 1997, and preserved a separate immigration quota for Hong Kong after 1997. McConnell's rhetoric and policy toward mainland China softened in the decades that followed. When Hong Kong's turnover approached in 1997, he reassured people like conservative writer Cal Thomas that China would become more free. Thomas explained that, as McConnell saw it, "In future years, it is probable that the People's Republic of China will look more and more like Hong Kong, and not the reverse." McConnell went on talk shows like Hardball with Chris Matthews on MSNBC and declared that the United States needed to be ambiguous as to whether we would come to the defense of Taiwan if attacked by China. "I think we're purposefully ambiguous. I think that's the place we ought to be." In 1999, Senate Committee on Foreign Relations Chairman Senator Jesse Helms introduced the Taiwan Security Enhancement Act. It was a show of support for a Taiwan independent of Chinese control. The bill had 21 co-sponsors and heavy Republican support, but McConnell was not on the list. Central to China's trade strategy was to get rid of a requirement that Congress had put in place following the Tiananmen Square massacre that required annual certification that the country was making progress on human rights to retain its trade status. In 2000, McConnell co-sponsored S-2277, which would do just that. The Chinese government had been fighting to get the requirement removed for years. Senator McConnell has worked to upend legislation that would be damaging to Beijing. In September 2011, the Currency Exchange Rate Oversight Reform Act, or S-1619, was introduced in the Senate. The bill punished countries with fundamentally misaligned currencies by tacking on import duties. While it did not explicitly target China, the bill was considered a direct response to China's undervalued currency, which threatened U.S. competitiveness in the international marketplace and made U.S. goods more expensive in China. McConnell was adamantly opposed to the bill. On October 6, 2011, he attempted to waylay the Senate Majority Leader, Senator Harry Reid, from taking the bill to a vote by suspending rules on the Senate floor and introducing amendments. The two rivals got into a heated, unscripted debate when McConnell supported 7 amendments to kill the bill. Reid then used a version of a rare procedure called the nuclear option to change the Senate rules that passed by the Democratic majority of the Senate and left McConnell fuming. On October 11, 2011, the bill passed with a 63-35 vote. McConnell voted against the measure. McConnell has defended his record regarding China by saying that he has been a consistent free trader regardless of the country. "I was a free trader long before I met Elaine," he told one newspaper, "and I think I've been on the free trade side of virtually every issue, not just related to China." But his record doesn't reflect that. On the issue of currency manipulation, he voted to impose sanctions on Japan for manipulating its currency and allegedly engaging in unfair practices to help their automobile industry. He has supported trade restrictions on Burma on account of its human rights record, and has called for protections of certain industries like tobacco during the Trans-Pacific Partnership. There is nothing in his previous record concerning any deals involving China. Likewise, Elaine Chao has been accused over the years of taking a soft position as it relates to China, and has avoided criticizing the government. During the 2008 Beijing Olympics, 8 Americans were arrested for trying to protest the Chinese occupation of Tibet. Chao was serving as the official U.S. representative to the Olympics. She publicly lauded the Olympics as a unique opportunity for the Chinese people to demonstrate the progress they have made and their sincere desire to engage with the world at every level, but never mentioned the arrests of the Americans or numerous human rights problems in the country. Anne Applebaum of the Washington Post criticized her comments as something that would reinforce the Chinese regime's legitimacy among its own people, cover up its bad record, and buff its image around the world, which was precisely what the Chinese regime had hoped people like her would do all along. While Chao was the Secretary of Labor in the George W. Bush administration, her department took positions that were beneficial to the Chinese government as well. The Department of Labor resisted efforts to call out the Chinese government over its worker rights practices. When a petition was filed with the federal government under Section 301 of the U.S. Trade Act of 1974 regarding workers' rights in the People's Republic of China, she opposed it. Instead, she pointed to the fact that her department had given millions of dollars in taxpayer grants to the Chinese government to provide workplace education programs. One could argue that in each of these instances that Chao was a representative of the U.S. government serving in a cabinet. She was echoing the policy line of the administration, not her own views. But you cannot make that argument when she traveled to China as a private citizen. In 2013, she accompanied her father to Peking University, where he delivered a speech entitled, "American in Spirit, Chinese at Heart." Elaine Chao answered questions from students after his presentation. She never mentioned any issues related to human rights or freedom of speech. "China has to find its own path," she told students, according to the university's version of the exchange. "You cannot adopt the American solutions without adjustment. China has to find its own solution to its own problems in its own way. You are going to be the leaders of China for the future, and so you should take pride in your Chinese culture, in your Chinese heritage, and help your country find its own path forward." She gave a curious interview to a Chinese-language newspaper called Tsingtao in July 2000 under her Chinese name, Zhao Sholan. In an article titled "Washington Penetrating Inspection, Exclusive Interview with Zhao Sholan," Chao spoke openly about a number of important issues between the United States and China. At the time of the interview, there was a lot of discussion in Washington about the Cox Report, a bipartisan congressional report on Chinese espionage against the United States and a series of illegal financial contributions made by Chinese officials to politicians in the United States. Chao was critical of the report and concerns about Chinese meddling in American politics. She made clear she in no way agreed with the report's findings, and she went on to dismiss the idea that China could pose any threat to the United States. "The U.S. is always happy to see an enemy, possibly because it serves a domestic policy purpose. And now that the Soviet Union doesn't exist and Russia is no longer the evil empire, some people without any reason make China the United States' enemy." She went on to criticize Democrats who raised questions about the human rights situation in China and who were worried about trade imbalances. She added, "Unfortunately, the Republican Party also has criticizers of China who are Christians and religious believers. They also talk about human rights and think China is an enemy. But compared to the Democrat side, they are apt to be well organized." She urged the Chinese government to fight a public relations battle in the United States. China also must come up with their own persuasive formula to win the public relations war. I'm saying to China, this is a new game China may have difficulty understanding. I believe China can do well. As McConnell gained political weight on Capitol Hill and his position toward China softened, the Chow family saw its business ties with the Chinese government increase dramatically, to their financial benefit. Recall that, as we saw earlier, China uses commercial ties to curry favor with foreign politicians. As scholar Jeffrey Reeves notes, China works to develop ties with a country's political elite and hopes to leverage elite relations to advance their interests in those countries. In Washington, it does not get much more elite than McConnell and Chow. Very few in Washington political circles know the extent to which the McConnell-Chow family is financially linked with Beijing. Indeed, the extent of their ties never comes up. But some of those ties are well known within the small circle of global shipping companies. As the shipping industry publication TradeWinds puts it, industry players describe Foremost Maritime as a low-profile shipping company with strong ties to China. They also say it has links with both the U.S. and Chinese governments. It is a phrase you see repeated over and over again in trade publications about Foremost. Close links with both the U.S. and Chinese governments. The links with the U.S. government, of course, are clear to us Westerners. Both Senator McConnell and Elaine Chao hold senior positions in government. Troubling links with the Chinese government are far murkier, if not obscured completely from the Western view. As McConnell and Chao were beginning their marriage, two trajectories developed simultaneously. Senator McConnell grew in seniority in the Senate, and the Chao family became increasingly intertwined financially with the Chinese government. The China State Shipbuilding Corporation describes James Chao as a business partner and friend of years as well. Foremost was a good client of China State Shipbuilding Corp., according to industry insiders. Before McConnell and Chao married, the family had two large cargo ships built by the Changnan shipyards in China, the Xingmei in 1990 and the Yumei in 1991. But 10 years later, by the summer of 2002, the Chao family was doing increasing volumes of business with the Chinese government and the government's Shanghai Waigaoqiao Shipbuilding Company, which produced for them Capesize ships, the largest dry cargo vessels in the world. These ships are so big they cannot transit the Suez Canal. Foremost Maritime would have CSSC construct 6 of the massive vessels at the yard over the next 4 years. Between 2001 and 2011, the company delivered 10 of the mammoth ships to Foremost. Dumei was built by Shanghai Waigaoqiao in 2004. They added the Anmei in 2005, built by the same shipyard. By 2006, they had ordered their 6th massive ship from the Shanghai Waigaoqiao shipbuilding yard. They had the Guomei built in 2011. By 2014, the Chows had ordered 6 180,000 DWT or dead weight ton bulkers at another government-owned shipyard, Qingdao Beihai Shipbuilding Heavy Industry Company. They cost $55 million apiece. Beihai reportedly sweetened a deal with the Chows when it squeezed out an early berth slot in late 2015 to accommodate one for the latest Foremost ships. Having your ships built in China in itself is no big deal. But the Chows became increasingly dependent on Beijing for their business success. The crews on their vessels are largely Chinese, and they operate out of Chinese ports carrying large amounts of raw materials in and out of China. Their clients include well-known Western companies like Cargill, but often Foremost is carrying goods for Chinese government-owned entities like Ezhou Steel and Wuhan Iron and Steel, or WISCO. But the ties became even closer. Soon both James Chow and Sister Angela were appointed to the board of directors of the Chinese State Shipbuilding Corporation Holdings Limited. You would not know it at first glance by looking at the company's documents, because they used modified names in corporate records. James Chow is listed as Zhao Shicheng. Angela Chow is listed as Zhao Anji. They joined the board just as the U.S. Senate was taking up sensitive legislation concerning China. CSSC Holdings is an offshoot of CSSC. It was formed to get private capital to enter China's defense industries. According to the annual reports of CSSC Holdings, the company is subsidized by the government, and the company's business includes doing military work. The Chows appear to be the only foreigners to serve on the company's board when they joined. As a state-owned defense conglomerate, CSSC is at the heart of the Chinese government's military-industrial complex. CSSC and China Shipbuilding Industry Corporation, or CSIC, are together the world's most prolific builders of large surface combatants and submarines. The CSSC is not shy about its role, describing itself as an extra-large conglomerate and state-authorized investment institution directly administered by the central government of China. The former chairman of the company, Hu Wenming, declared that the company's number one priority is building military products, and he vows the company will continue in strengthening the Chinese military. He adds that CSSC's cadres and workers are deeply encouraged and inspired to take on the responsibility of using ships to serve the country. CSSC, while the Chows served on the board of directors of CSSC Holdings, played a central role in this massive Chinese naval buildup. By 2020, many naval experts believe that China is on course to deploy greater quantities of missiles with greater ranges than those systems potentially employed by the U.S. Navy against them. And according to the China Maritime Studies Institute at the U.S. Naval War College, the Chinese shipbuilding industry appears to be on a trajectory to build a combat fleet that could be, in hardware terms, quantitatively and qualitatively on par with that of the U.S. Navy by 2030. The fact that both the father-in-law and sister-in-law of Senator McConnell sat on the board of CSSC Holdings is highly unusual, to say the least. One could say it is unprecedented in American political history. In general, CSSC is a sensitive, critical asset for the Chinese government and operates under a veil of privacy and secrecy. Details about CSSC are very opaque, says Julian Snelder, a partner in a global investments fund at a conference organized by the China Maritime Studies Institute at the U.S. Naval War College. The company consists of a variety of mixed civil-military complexes, including sensitive research institutes that are secretly operated and report directly to the government's state council. Senator McConnell and Elaine Chao do not have a direct ownership stake in Foremost Group, but clearly they are beneficiaries of its financial success. In 2008, they received a gift from James Chao of between $5 million and $25 million. This dramatically increased McConnell's personal wealth, more than doubling it. They reasonably stand to receive other gifts as family fortunes allow. Financial success for Foremost means financial success for McConnell and his wife. But the money flowing from the Chinese government to the McConnell-Chow family goes beyond shipbuilding. Elaine Chao, when not serving in government, has given paid speeches to Chinese government entities for years. It is unclear how much she has been paid for these speeches. She does not disclose her speaking fees on Senator McConnell's annual disclosure form, but her fee is as much as $50,000. Speakers commonly charge more if they are required to travel overseas to deliver the address. It is impossible to know precisely how many Chinese government entities have put how much money in Chow's pockets over the years. Repeated questions sent to Chow about these speeches went unanswered. In 2013, Chao participated in the Chinese government's Boao Forum for Asia, which was headlined by Chinese President Xi Jinping. The event included speeches and attendees that included a long list of ministers, provincial governors, and party secretaries. Called the Davos of Asia, the event is constructed so that politicians and business leaders who want insights into trade with China can meet with government officials. She has also given talks to other government forums like the Forum on ICT and Urban Development in Ningbo. Along the way, she collected fees for addressing numerous Chinese government-controlled universities like Tsinghua University in Beijing, Peking University, and Fudan University. In 2009, she addressed the China Center for International Economic Exchanges, which is known for its links to the Chinese government. As was the case with Bill Clinton and his speaking fees while Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, it is fair to ask how those fees might be paying for more than podium time. Paying a spouse a hefty speaking fee can be a lucrative tool for currying favor with a power broker. As Elaine Chao was being paid these fees by Chinese government entities, her husband was the Republican leader or Senate majority leader in the U.S. Senate, grappling with an abundance of legislation that would affect China's interests. Elaine Chao's financial ties to mainland China also include corporate relationships. In the past, she has sat on the board of a broadband company called Multicom, which was offering direct internet links between China and the United States through a joint venture with the Chinese government's China Unicom. She failed to disclose that position when she joined the George W. Bush administration as Secretary of Labor. "The lack of disclosure was an inadvertent omission," said Chao's spokesperson. The author repeatedly contacted the offices of both Senator McConnell and Secretary Chao about the family's close financial ties with the Chinese government. They have not responded. During the 2016 presidential election, the Chinese government watched warily as Donald Trump charged them with engaging in a variety of unfair economic practices. Trump accused Beijing of manipulating its currency, protectionism, and stealing American intellectual property. He also intimated that he saw the country as a rising military threat. When Trump won, there was disquiet in Beijing about what might lie ahead. 10 days after Trump's win, the government-run Bank of China made an announcement. As we've seen in other chapters, the Bank of China is deeply embedded in China's political structure. It is run by a trusted group of managers who are politically savvy. As the Congressional Research Service notes, all of China's banks share a common governance system, involving senior bank officers, board of directors, and a board of supervisors. The senior bank officers are members of the Chinese Communist Party, or CCP, and are appointed by the CCP. The officers are also assigned ranks in the Chinese government's hierarchy, ranging from the equivalent of a bureau chief to a vice minister. As a result, the bank's board of directors includes all senior Chinese officials and one lone Dutch banker. But now they would be getting a new member, Senator McConnell's sister-in-law, Angela Chao. One has to ask, with the Chao family so financially linked to the Chinese government, how can this not affect McConnell's view on policy toward China? Being in favor with Beijing has built this family's empire, and losing favor could ruin the family's shipping fortunes overnight. It seems that in both Beijing and Washington, it pays to have friends and family in high places. But the rise of the princelings on Capitol Hill goes far beyond just Senator McConnell. 6. The Princelings of K Street. Foreign entities and American corporations have discovered that hiring the children of powerful politicians as lobbyists is the best way to get access to them. Some politicians are building family empires this way, with as many as 3 family members cashing in. Missoula, Montana is a long way from Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia. The span across the globe is 5,639 miles, to be exact. But if you want to get from the one to the other, the shortest route might not be to head west over the Pacific Ocean. Instead, you might try going through Washington, D.C. Congressman Denny Rehberg was a plain-speaking rancher when he was elected to the House of Representatives in 2000. The former lieutenant governor was unopposed in the Republican primary and won the general election comfortably. As a rising GOP star, he was eventually given a seat on the powerful House Committee on Appropriations, a highly prized appointment, because that body largely controls the purse strings for the federal government and determines how hundreds of billions of dollars will be spent every year in our nation's capital. Rehberg checked all of the conventional boxes. He joined the Republican Study Committee and the Congressional Rural Caucus. He became a prodigious fundraiser. He sat on the powerful Subcommittee on Energy and Water Development and chaired another on health and labor issues. But Rehberg also did something unconventional. He helped launch a small congressional group called the U.S.-Mongolia Friendship Caucus. A caucus is a voluntary group that allows congressmen with a particular interest to meet together and work on common issues related to it. The Rural Caucus, for example, includes congressmen from rural districts. The 5-member U.S.-Mongolia Friendship Caucus was established to strengthen relations between the United States and the landlocked country known for Genghis Khan between Russia and China. Why would a Montana politician launch such a caucus? Factoring in the business activities of A.J. Rehberg, the congressman's son, helps explain the seemingly serendipitous goodwill. In 2007, shortly after graduating from Seattle University, A.J. Rehberg went to work for a Washington, D.C. lobbying firm called Gage. The firm was headed by Leo Giacometto, a former chief of staff to Montana Senator Conrad Burns. By 2011, the firm's lobbying clients included the government of Mongolia. According to federal records, Gage was even lobbying Congressman Rehberg's Committee on Appropriations on behalf of the Mongolian government. Their paid work included formation of the U.S.-Mongolia Congressional Caucus, which Rehberg, of course, helped launch, and to promote trade. The required lobbying disclosure form lists Giacometto and Ryan Thomas of Gage as the lobbyists for the government of Mongolia. But according to the Mongolian embassy in Washington, A.J. Rehberg was actually the primary point of contact for the firm's work with the embassy. Gage confirmed this as well in a press release. Around the same time, the congressman's son, now about 4 years out of college, became a vice president of a uranium company called Mongolia Forward. Based out of Washington, D.C., the company was involved in a joint venture agreement with the Mongolian government's state-owned uranium company that authorized Mongolia Forward to explore, mine, and process uranium in Mongolia. The goal was to import the precious metal into the United States. A.J. Rehberg had no background in the nuclear industry. His job at Mongolia Forward was to serve as vice president for public and government affairs. Gage actually lobbied Congressman Rehberg's Committee on Appropriations on behalf of A.J.'s company, according to federal records, on issues related to exploration, mining, and international trade. How much A.J. was paid by the Mongolian Uranium Company has never been disclosed. A.J. also became involved in several other Mongolian business ventures, including a fiber optic network company and the first Pepsi bottling plant in the country. Doing business in Mongolia is not for the faint at heart and requires powerful connections with the government in order to succeed. It is considered one of the more corrupt countries in the world, according to Transparency International around this time. It ranks worse than China, Jamaica, and numerous African countries. As a member of the Committee on Appropriations, Congressman Rehberg was ideally positioned to help the Mongolians. In 2007, the Mongolian government signed a compact worth $285 million in U.S. taxpayer money for infrastructure projects in the country. That included plans to improve a railroad that was partly owned by the Mongolian government. The purpose of the railroad would be to transport minerals, including uranium. Beginning in 2009, Rehberg also sat on the House Appropriations Subcommittee on Energy and Water Development, which meant that he had oversight of the Department of Energy, or DOE, and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, or NRC. The Mongolian government's hopes of importing uranium into the United States through AJ's company were contingent on approval from both government bodies. In 2012, Congressman Rehberg decided to run for the U.S. Senate in Montana. He lost. Shortly after he gave up his congressional seat, he joined the lobbying firm Mercury. We have seen how the family members of vice presidents, secretaries of states, and Senate leaders have benefited from foreign entities endowing them with favorable business deals in the interest of currying favor. The Rehberg case is simply a snapshot of evidence showing how this happens in Congress, too, even with relatively obscure congressmen. If proximity is power, it is hard to get closer to a politician than by going into business with a member of their family or paying a member of their family for a service. In countries like China and Mongolia, princeling-style corruption commonly informs political decisions. It has become increasingly that way in the United States as well. As Craig Holman, an ethics expert at the watchdog group Public Citizen, puts it, special interests that have pending business before a member of Congress often look to throw money at the feet of a family member. That way, these lobbies can still use their connections at arm's length to get access. Many D.C. lobbying firms spend lavishly on politicians' family members. Back in 2012, the Washington Post reported that more than 500 firms have spent more than $400 million on lobbying teams that include the relatives of members of the House and Senate. This chapter tells a fraction of the stories that those numbers represent. Many elected officials see public office as a business enterprise, with family members orbiting around them, positioned to strike lucrative deals with foreign and American entities eager to curry favor from the powerful. In this charade of public service, bloodlines grow wealthy at the expense of public policy, and the American public takes a back seat to the highest bidder. One example very well could be Congressman Bill Shuster of Pennsylvania, who comes from a powerful political family that has been deeply embedded in politics since the 1890s. Bill's father, Bud Shuster, held the Keystone State's 9th Congressional District seat for almost 30 years. When Bud announced his retirement in 2000, Bill immediately announced that he was running to replace him, and won. As a result, for now more than four decades, the Shusters have represented this region of rural Pennsylvania in Congress. And along the way, they have developed a family empire of lobbying contracts. In January 2013, Bill Shuster returned to Washington after the Christmas break and was made chairman of the powerful House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, a committee that his father had once chaired. The influential body controls spending on roadways, automobiles, railways, mass transit, the airline industry, and pipelines. In short, the committee moves a lot of taxpayer money around. At the ceremony marking his appointment, Shuster brought his father Bud, his mother Patricia, and brother Bob into the chamber to introduce them to the committee members. This was unusual, even by Washington standards. It's uncommon for family members to be introduced at these meetings, noted one industry publication. The apparently maudlin move belied an ulterior motive. Both Bud and Bob were registered lobbyists for transportation interests. Bud was running a lobbying shop called Strategic Advisors, Incorporated, based out of his home in Everett, Pennsylvania. Over the years, he has collected millions from interests like the Association of American Railroads, or AAR, and other clients. In 2012, he was a registered lobbyist for the AAR. Bill, who was chairman of the full committee, also sat on Transportation's Subcommittee on Railroads, Pipelines, and Hazardous Materials, with direct authority over the railroad industry. Brother Bob was also lobbying for several transportation companies with matters before the committee. From his K Street office, he represented firms like Regent Corporation on issues relating to positive train control and Canada Steamship Lines regarding maritime transportation issues. The Chamber of Maritime Commerce and Industry Trade Group was paying him to lobby on transportation and maritime issues. The House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee holds sway on issues beyond just transportation. For example, Bill's committee oversees energy pipelines and safety regulations that pertain to them. His brother Bob was hired by the EQT Energy Company to lobby on pipeline safety initiatives. Of particular concern to the company was a piece of legislation called H.R. 2845, Pipeline Safety, Regulatory Certainty, and Job Creation Act, which was sponsored by Shuster and went through his committee. EQT was apparently happy with the work of the Shuster brothers. They were paying Bob to lobby while also giving Bill's campaigns the largest share of their political contributions over the last two elections. Bob's lobbying firm biography notes that he focuses his practice primarily in the areas of infrastructure projects and appropriations for transportation. Areas that, of course, just happen to overlap with his brother's committee. Congressman Bill Shuster has a daughter named Allison Shuster, who is now a lobbyist for Primerica, Incorporated. Although her lobbying is not directly tied to the Transportation Committee, there are now three generations of the Schuster family circling Congressman Schuster like moons around a